Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Caribbean Critical Theory podcast. My name's Charlie. I'm here with Lisa and Tegan to talk about the Manifesto in Praise of Creoleness by Jean Bernabé, Patrice Chemoiseau, Raphael Confiant. This was published in 1990. In class, we spent a fair amount of time discussing sort of the political or intra-movement or intra-Caribbean dynamics that this sort of manifesto created, and the ways that expat Caribbeans responded to it, particularly Edouard Glissant, but others. And we're going to continue that conversation, I think, next week, it sounds like. Our intention is to pivot from that conversation and focus a little bit more on the argument itself and think about what we saw mentioned in it and what we kind of sort of expected but didn't find, and also to look more carefully at some of its themes, because it seems to be a lot of urgency to the manifesto itself, and it's a energizing and provocative and exciting piece. I think what maybe where we can start is we've discussed the theme, the idea of race and its explicit absence, or it's not that it's, I guess the question that I think we can begin with is, what is the role of race in this argument compared with the way it's discussed in, you know, other Black studies traditions and negritude? Tegan had some initial reactions from that. So why don't we start with you, Tegan?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. So every week, I come into these readings asking, what does this have to say about Blackness? And that's just kind of, I wouldn't even say that I'm doing that super intentionally. I just kind of find myself thinking that, or like looking for that every time I read our like assigned readings for the week. And part of that is just informed by kind of like my research background, where I've like focused a lot on Blackness, whiteness, Afro-pessimism, social death, things like that. And like racialization and all of these things. And then I guess another part of that is because we also started the course on negritude, which is pretty explicitly focused on Blackness through Africanness. And then we move into Fanon, which is also very explicitly focused on ideas of Blackness and whiteness. So I tend to find myself always asking that and like looking for commentary on Blackness. And I guess I almost feel like I didn't find what this week's reading had to say about Blackness. I think it is just more focused on this idea of Caribbeanness and Creoleness, which I mean, I don't think those are like distinct. But I guess I just found it interesting that I couldn't necessarily spot like the conversation on, I just wasn't sure what it had to say about Blackness, or if it was trying to say anything about Blackness other than, if anything, I think it is kind of more so tying into the rejection of the idea, or just at least a distancing from the idea that there is a commonality among like all African, like all Black people of African descent in the diaspora. Like it's a lot more focused on the idea of a commonality in Creoleness and Caribbeanness. And like I tended to assume that they were talking about Black Caribbeans and people who are like Black and Creole, but then I realized that if I like kept thinking about it, I didn't necessarily see the text distinguishing between people who would consider themselves Caribbean or Creole and non-Black or not having any sort of African descent, even though the text would like every now and then explicitly mention or name like Black people. But I just, I don't know. I had a, like, my thoughts are a little spacey, so hopefully you guys can help kind of like narrow it down, like now that I'm trying to like say it out loud. But I don't know. I guess I was just wondering, if the focus of like Caribbeanness or Creoleness is this idea of a mixing of peoples and cultures, what does that mean for someone who is Creole but has like, does that mean people who had like different ancestries and different like physical appearances but who are in the same country and could be considered Creole or speak Creole, are they the same, or is actually, does that person just not exist? Like, are all the people like who speak Creole, like, do they all consider themselves Black as well? Like, I don't know. I was just like realizing that I kind of assumed that this, I, and like Lisa mentioned that there was this assumed Black audience, but then I realized I didn't know why I was assuming it was a Black audience. And like, if I was right to have been thinking that, or if it was just my own like preconceived like understandings and like, or assumptions that made me think that like Blackness would be like a central aspect of this text. If that makes sense.
That makes so much sense, Tegan. And now hearing you talk about this again, it's making me also question my own assumptions about the Black audience. And I want to go back to the first line where it says, let me find it quickly. It says, neither Europeans nor Africans nor Asians, we proclaim ourselves Creoles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, I think that will be the source of your question and your mm-hmm. doubts about this, about Blackness mm-hmm. being missing in this text. So it's premised on this idea that we Creoles could be from anywhere, right?
Yeah.
And again, this also then opens up the conversation that we had yesterday about the totality of Creoleness or the universality of Creoleness and what Glissant will think about this question of what we are. And that's, it's making me think about this, because when I read this also like as a Black person, I was like, okay, this is just speaking to us.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm thinking about the people in Martinique who we know from previous readings were of some were of Indian ancestry, some Chinese, and things like that. So yeah, you're right to point out that there's the audience
mm-hmm.
or Blackness is not very distinct here.
Mm-hmm.
And this also questions, again, what it means to be Creole. Is it just simply the mixing of it, or is it just a matter of Blackness? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the placement of these authors writing from Martinique has to have a lot of weight here, is my guess. Just and because of the presence of Fanon and Fanon's ideas in like throughout this work, it seems like because Creoleness is trying to like create its own identity independent mm-hmm. of the other and its European other, and because Fanon is so adamant that to understand oneself as Black is to be like infected by a subjectivity that is created by the other
mm-hmm.
and others you. It seems like it seems like the framework of Blackness, like these authors are, they want to reject it on two planes, which is like against the negritude mm-hmm. movement, which says that we're all somehow essentially the same, like of a people, even though we come from very different cultures and histories and whatnot. They don't love that. And they don't love the fact that, well, if we call ourselves Black, that's what we were called on the basis of our subjugation and the subjectivity that's like formed in by, you know, imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's like, it's you get this feeling reading Glissant too, which is like, oh, we're just going to be postmodern, like unrooted, you know, we're not going to, we're all just going to meld. We're going to break with our traumatic past and our fathers. And it's like, well, I don't know. There's a powerful, especially in the US, I mean, just the thinking race and thinking through race is like it feels like that's completely untenable politically mm-hmm. to just say, well, now race is like, we're all this kind of, we're going to try to unstitch race from our subjectivity and by ignoring it entirely or trying to mm-hmm. reject it entirely. That's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a hard question, but I'm going through, there's a line on page 888 when they talk about Césaire, when they're saying that, I'm guessing this is where the answer, something to respond to Tegan's question about this. It says two forms of exteriority which proceed from two opposed logics, one monopolizing our minds submitted to this torture. So I'm thinking that maybe it could be anyone who was submitted to this torture of coloniality who was present in the Caribbean, right? So it's not just about race. It could be all of those people with those different ancestries who were submitted to this torture of coloniality and the scars that were inscribed on them
mm-hmm.
by this coloniality, I guess. I think that's what it gets at. And I think that's what Charlie's saying. It's not just about, it's not a race question.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about a relational, to quote Césaire, no, not Césaire, Glissant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand these concepts of Creoleness and Caribbeanness as kind of being like opposed to the idea of negritude in the sense of like negritude being this idea of like instead of being European, like we are we as in like the like people of like Martinique, people of the Caribbean who are of African descent, like that we are African, and like trying to like embrace that instead of the Europeanness that has been like poorly forced on them. And I think it makes sense to not be satisfied with that either, and to just kind of say like there's no need for like a return, or to say that we are actually this other like origin thing, we are something entirely different, we are Caribbean, we are Creole, and that like that all makes sense to me. But I think something that you can have at the same time is not necessarily like a return to Africanness, but I think you can have at the same time a recognition of being Caribbean, being Creole, and being Black in the sense of, like, I think there is something where being Creole and being Caribbean is different from being African, and it's different from being Black or Black American, African American. But I do also think you can have that and at the same time have a recognition that there is a common experience that still persists, that is rooted in the label of Blackness and the persistence of anti-Blackness on a global scale. But I feel like sometimes, like, I guess that's just like something that I feel like needs, like, I would add that, like, other people have said that, like, that, like, I feel like is an important part of, like, I don't know, like, just something that, like, I, like, feels like is missing from this manifesto that, like, again, I can't help but be like, well, is, like, what make, is this about Blackness? Am I, is Blackness missing? Is it there? And it's, like, the subtext. Am I assuming that it's supposed to be there when it's, like, not there? But I do feel like you can have both at the same time, even though they're sometimes framed as, like, opposites, because I feel like this idea, even though Fanon didn't even like negritude, I feel like the idea of, like, having this global commonality throughout the entire diaspora of just Blackness is attached to this idea of having a common African descent. But I think for a lot of, like, maybe sociopolitical scholars, the ancestry is less important than, kind of like what I said in class the other day, that it's almost like the lived experience is why the common experience of Blackness matters, not necessarily the African ancestry, which is why we can acknowledge at the same time that, like, there are also, of course, differences between Black people in the diaspora. But I think, yeah, like I said, I think you can have both at the same time.
Yeah. You can definitely have both, and you can recognize both. And I think what these guys are trying to do, at least, is to just, I don't know if they recognize both, but they're just moving forward with whatever that they have in that moment. But also in recognizing both, I think that's what Walcott did when he when he said that he recognizes that he has a father in Africa and then a father sort of in Europe, but he doesn't want to have anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. That's also one way to, like, deal with this, to recognize that you have those, but you don't want to have anything to do with that. And I think in a way these guys do that in the way that they call Césaire's idea of negritude anti-Creole. Yes, and recognizing that he had something valuable to say, but just that negritude was fine, but it was just, like, before Creole, before they recognizing that there's sort of like a forward mobility to Creoleness that negritude couldn't provide for them, right? I think that's what we're doing, and I like that a lot. I like the use of that anti-Creole a lot. It wasn't demonizing or just negating what Césaire said entirely. It was like, okay, we get what you're saying, but maybe your thoughts are just, like, before, and that's okay to have thoughts like that, to place that as, like, a before Creole. I like that. So I think that's where they recognize the two, but it's also like, okay, we see this, but what are we going to do with it in our present moment, in our present mixing, in this situation, what we're going to do with it? That's where I guess they birth Creole, but whatever, they do something with the Creole now.
Well, yeah, that was, I think, a really insightful place to bring us, Lisa. I like where we got with that. And yeah, maybe it's a good time to transition to sort of how that Creoleness is expressed or comes about, you know, and like what it is. And it seems that language has a lot to do with what it actually is, and how it becomes, and sort of what that interior vision like sounds like, or if we can, like, I don't know, there's a lot happening with like vision, language, thought, self, like, and I'm thinking of Winter's like descriptive statements, like self-description, and how that's key to kind of being, like, how does a Creole self like understand itself, and like what is the role of language in that, and like, I think, yeah, I'm gonna repeat what I just said, but it feels like vision and language are intertwined in a way where the metaphors don't always sort of match for me. So maybe where we could start is like, I guess I'll continue by saying we've wondered as a group here, like, why the manifesto trying to inaugurate Creoleness as a, you know, an aesthetic and self-definitional like engine, why it's written in French still, you know, and what that says about the audience of this piece, and what it says about where we're at in the creolization of the world and the sort of development of Caribbean and Creole culture and you know, literary culture in the eyes of, you know, the writers who are doing this. Yeah, I think that's like, Lisa keeps mentioning the idea that there will always be, or that the surrealists were prophesying artists who would bring about a real and true art. And this feels like a repetition of that pattern. While also they're acknowledging that there are like, there is a legacy of people who have, you know, been bringing this tradition forward in certain, and, you know, writing in Creole, but they're not addressed here. They're sort of displayed or name checked. I mean, this is not a criticism. I think there are like so many this is an important piece and I love it. And I don't think it has to be in Creole to be for real. But what are the complexities there? You know, I think they're significant.
I think that, were you about to say something?
Yeah, I was, but it's okay. You go ahead.
No, go ahead, because I'm still a little, like, formulating as I go, so.
Yeah, it was just like a tiny little thing that I wanted to say that maybe Creole was very new, that even they themselves had not gathered. No, I cannot say that, because Creoleness was that mixing, that plantation language. So it wasn't that new. I wanted to say that because there isn't much of a system for the Creole language, and it's built off on what people bring into forming what the language is, that there wasn't like a clear system that could be easily understood by everyone. Mm-hmm. So I guess French then was like the universal, I hate to say this, it was a universalizing language for them. But also, yeah, this is a good question, Charlie. Why didn't they write this in French? Because they keep saying that French forced us to denigrate ourselves on page 890, they say that French made us, wait, let me go there quickly and see so that I don't miss it. It's page 890. They say that we lose any part of ourselves hidden behind French ways. So yeah, if they were really about the money, they should have walked the walk, like writing this in Creole instead of just writing this in French. But again, it was a universalizing language. It was a manifesto. They wanted everyone to hear them. I mean, if you want people's votes, you want to speak to them in the language that they understand first before. So when you get their vote, you're like, okay, now we're going to do this and we're going to show you how to do it. But also, I don't know. This was written in 1990, right? Yeah. And I just checked the book that I wanted to use for a paper in class, The Lonely Londoners, and that was written entirely in Creole and it was published in 1956. So that's also like, okay, they really could have, if they wanted to, they could have written this in Creole. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you say was published in 1996?
The Lonely Londoners. It's a novel by Samuel Selvon.
Mm-hmm. You said in 1956, right?
1956, yes. Not 1956. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, maybe one way to think of this is like, just because these authors come together to name this doesn't mean that it doesn't already exist and hasn't already really been existing.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I know we were talking about how in class we were talking about, oh, well, Glissant and these expat Caribbean writers, like they're processing their own alienation from their homeland and their distance and their memory. But, you know, Bernabe, Chamazo, Confiant, like, they're also different from many of the people that they're trying to think with and about, you know, in that they're alienated from a Creole-speaking population by virtue of, you know, their fluency in a French and in a, like, intellectual tradition. You know, so maybe it's almost like it reminds me of the peasant figures that have in the Plant Man, like the ways that like, you know, figures that have been evoked as like maybe kind of like pure cultural figures who are not sort of westernized the way that these intellectuals are. And, you know, maybe there's just like a degree that these intellectuals like can't reach or produce this culture as much as they want to like see it take place and like erupt and flower, you know. And like maybe they write this with no real hope that this really like affects anybody directly involved in the creation of this art. Because if you can read it, you're probably like already so distanced from the sort of literary culture that you're probably not really a key part of that movement.
Yeah, they also admit that this is a difficult thing to undertake. Same page 890, they say that this was easier to say than do because the paths of penetration in Caribbeanness were not marked. And then they go on to say that to create the conditions for authentic expression meant also to exercise the old fatality of exteriority, which is like a difficult thing for them to do. It's not something that they can simply just detach from. It'll take so much to like untwine or unbraid themselves from. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that does touch on self-acceptance, which is, you know, a major plank of this argument.
Yeah, I think a lot of the reasons why, like, you know, this manifesto is in French, I think it all, at the end of the day, comes to kind of just pragmatic reasons. And not just in the sense that, because I think there is an aspect of, like, you know, French can like untranslated reach a wider audience. There is a sort of, and I, this might have been a better thing to say in class, because I hope I don't like say anything that's actually just like wrong, because I'm about to say that like French has this sort of like global standard that gets kind of traced back to like the proper way of saying things in like standard French. And obviously even in France, people are going to speak French differently and they're going to say things differently. But then there is like one standard set of rules for how to speak French in a way that I don't think really exists for Creole, because Creole can differ a lot. There's not like a standard, like something to return to, like, that is like a, like sort of the guide. So in that way, it's like French reaches a wider audience of like French speakers. And then if it gets translated, there are more people, like it's more accessible to be translated because more people speak French. So now we have it in English that we can read, which may not have happened if it were not written in a sort of standard French. But even outside of that, like, even if it were not like an intentional choice of theirs, it's unlikely that these authors were taught to write in Creole the way that they were taught to write in French. And it's actually very difficult to write in a language that you only have experience hearing and speaking. Even if you knew how to like spell all of the words, like just writing is such a different experience from speaking. I mean, there are people who like even just like hell in like the same language. Like, I feel like I could say something out loud, and then when I go to sit down to put it on paper, like I'm struggling immensely just because like our speaking voice is so different from our writing voice. And I feel like they might just not know how to have a written Creole voice in the way that they know how to have a written French voice. And again, for all of those reasons, and I mean, that might even be part of the like orality of Creole. And it kind of makes me think of like, it makes me think of the poem that we read by Kamau, and like the existence of like patois, and how there's not like a standard for speaking languages that are considered variants of English, or like for speaking different like Caribbean patois languages. And I think some of like how to write it is kind of a guess. I think, I mean, and even I think a lot of it is like there's some like guesswork to it, because there is, or there's just like personal preference, like spell the word however makes sense to you, because there's not like a global dictionary that says, oh, this is the way to spell it. And I don't think there has to be. And that kind of, feel free to ignore this if you have other thoughts, because that like this might be a different direction, but Dalton mentioned in class the other day that they found a dictionary, and I think it was essentially like a Creole dictionary. I think I could be misremembering that where they had interviewed people to figure out like all these different words and variants of words and how to define them. And I remember thinking this, I was with them when they found it. And I remember thinking this at the time, that this immediately presents a conflict to me that I could see people having, where it's like, oh, this dictionary, legitimizes the language. Oh, why do we need a dictionary to legitimize the language? Why can't it just be, like an oral centric language that doesn't have written standards, that has like various meaning, which isn't to say like, no, yeah, it's It's just an interesting dilemma that I think the existence of this dictionary would present a lot of people. Just this idea of this conflict of legitimacy and like whether a project like that brings legitimacy and I'm just repeating myself, why that legitimacy is needed, things like that. That was just like my immediate thought with the existence of that dictionary.
Yeah. And also to touch on the universality of French and how it makes this possible for us to access, they also say that Creoleness is an annihilation of false universality, mm-hmm. of monolingualism, and of purity. So I guess that's why we cannot present one mm-hmm. sort of Creoleness for a manifesto such as this.
Yeah. And I can see the utility of, I mean, like a manifesto is a very, it's not a cultural, it's like trying to have a cultural conversation and an aesthetic conversation, but it is not itself like an aesthetic product, mm-hmm. or it doesn't have those goals. Like it doesn't, they don't, like these people wrote novels that were incredibly multilingual. Mm-hmm. And incredibly like linguistically sophisticated, and you know, I'm not saying they didn't practice what they preached, because they absolutely like made lives of doing just that, and like are like I can't assess the success of those, but it seems like people generally understand them to be quite successful. So I'm sympathetic to the idea that like, okay, if they're trying to like clear a space, and or like plant something in the ground, and you kind of need some like earth moving equipment for that. Mm-hmm. Not like you're not kind of, yeah. There's a like a way where marrying form and content too much just like doesn't serve the content. It makes sense to me. I think it is an interesting point about like an oral language and what is it? Does it kind of trivialize? What does it do? What does it actually mean to bring that down to earth when you're trying to make a point that's really ensconced in like Western intellectual structures, you know, that just, what does that juxtaposition really say? And does it serve anybody? I'm not really sure. It makes me think of this. I mean, this is kind of random, but Lisa and I are, in particular, as members of the English department, we are instructed in the academic writing, like 101 academic writing course. And the English department is like big on linguistic diversity. Which creates these like really interesting conversations. Like there's an essay that's written that, you know, is assigned to 101 students, and it's like written in this Black vernacular. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of trying to do that. I wonder what your experience of it is, Lisa. And obviously I don't really have like cultural standing for this. But it comes off to me like when you're trying to make the case for linguistic diversity, but in a vernacular that you're claiming, I don't know. It does read like essentialism from a distance, depending on how it's performed. I don't know. It's like I asked ChatGPT to try to do the same thing using the ideology of linguistic diversity. And it kept backing away. It didn't want to, but then I use those ethics to like really force it into it. And then it acquiesced, and then it just produced just like really offensive shit, you know, like it is asking us to,
I don't know, putting Creole on paper and saying this is what Creole is, it does contradict the idea of Creoleness, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That is true.
Like what?
But yeah. Also,
yeah, yeah.
It is, I don't know, when I read that text, I felt like, okay, this is cool. This is a way to get your foot in the door mm-hmm. and to like make something a possibility rather than just theorizing it all the time, to just give an actual example of it. So that's what I thought about it. I was like, yes, it is essentializing in a way. But it's also the same way that I feel about the BBC Service Pigeon edition, right? Because there's a whole service dedicated to Pigeon English where you can just read the news in Pigeon. It's also like, okay, what is this about? Because there isn't one Pidgin language, and that is actually written in just Nigerian Pidgin. So it's also like, okay, is this the Pidgin that we're picking to represent like universal corpus of Pidgin Englishes? So that's how I got. Also, it's a way to get the foot in the door to like introduce that language to other people. If you don't do it, then you can't say that you have tried. Right, so you just have to make that effort to make that first step.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess the fact that it's uncomfortable and it provokes important questions should be like a validation of the approach in some ways.
Yeah.
I remember kind of similar. The University of Florida was my undergrad institution, and while I was there, they eventually started offering a course in Haitian Creole. That is like, having grown up in Florida, that was kind of like when people say Creole, I always usually just kind of assumed Haitian Creole. I feel like this class is the first time I've really been exposed to a lot of conversation on like Creoleness and other forms of Creole and Creole languages in a way that is not specifically referring to Haitian Creole, like strictly or explicitly. But I do think that's just like, I don't know if I even have a real point, but just I think that like, you know, they didn't try and say like, this is a class on Creole, you know, they said this is Haitian Creole to indicate that like, it's a Creole that's going to be like relevant to Haiti, and that there's not just like one Creole. And even like, I feel like Arabic is an interesting language where I don't know like the differences intimately, but like Arabic is a language where like, 'cause there is something, there is standard Arabic that does exist. But if you take a course, you can take courses in regional Arabic because it is different enough that it might be hard to understand. Like if you learn Moroccan Arabic, it might be hard to go elsewhere and speak Moroccan Arabic and be easily understood or easily understand others. But like the interesting thing with Arabic, like I said, is that they do still have standard Arabic, and that's what's going to get taught in like most courses in like the United States if you take an Arabic course.
That's an interesting, really interesting example to contrast with other like linguistic traditions, because it's not like we understand it more easily as something that has more regional and cultural variation because it's not like structured by nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like if like Spanish is like, you don't, yeah. I mean, like people are like, it's definitely a transferable language, but Spanish is like really like in the image of Spain, is like, that's a really dominant sort of like way of understanding Spanish, even though like Cuban Spanish and Argentine Spanish and Spanish from Spain are all like, you know, incredibly different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we should wrap up soon.
Mm-hmm.
If there's like, do you guys mind if I throw something out and we can each kind of like weigh in a little bit and call it there? I guess what I understood, or like what I keep thinking about in relation to Glisson and in relation to like the thrust of this argument and like the passion of the argument, is it's like futurity.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is like a thing you think about a lot, Lisa. What do you think about the assertion that like the world is becoming Creole, and that kind of future and the Creole writer's sense of them as seeing this first and being the first example, but everyone is going to be like them down the road. Any comments on that claim?
Well, I think it's a valid claim, right? Because in the end, people are becoming more and more mixed with cultures, I think, with the food, with music. There's so many fusions going on that Creole is like the, was, or should I say is or was like the beginning of these things. So I see that in the future, there's going to be difficulty in identifying the purity of certain things, right? And even for someone like me, who has sort of like engaged with different cultures from Africa, I've lived in Europe, and now I'm in America, there's this mix, and it's the same for a lot of people who are traveling now that the world is very global. And also in the age of the internet, where it's like on certain platforms, you can't really tell like cultural differences because you speak the same way. There's a certain kind of lingo that goes on there that we cannot ascribe to like a singular sort of identity. So I get that. It's a really, really valid point to make that in the end, the world will become so creolized that we wouldn't be able to give like distinct or show the purity of certain cultures. And I like that. I think I like that a lot as an Afrofuturist. I like the idea of mixing and creating things from our situation. Yeah.
Cool.
I can't help but be deeply skeptical of it. I don't know if I am just letting other conceptualizations interfere with my ability to think of it like in a different way, but like I just can't help but think of this idea of like multicultural neoliberalism and kind of treating like this like weird attitude of like multiracial people being like the embodiment of the future, like because someone has like that like diver, like I've heard like weird expressions of like, oh, like diversity is like in their blood, and like that, like I guess, yeah, it just like,
yeah,
there could be more to it than like what I'm currently relating it to, and like giving like it like there, maybe there's more to give it credit for, the idea credit for, but I just can't help but like think of it as this idea that like, you know, world peace will be solved by like when we're all speak, like when we're like all so mixed together that like we're all like one big like culture that's like the mix of like all the cultures and races and like I don't know, it just has this like weird multiracial idealism to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a strong.
I would like to say that I'm an idealist and I'm a dreamer. So let's just leave it like at that. I get your skepticism, but I'm also like, yay to mixing and everybody creating things from it. And that's just the way I roll. Yeah. But thank you for being the realist in this conversation.
I don't know. It's really interesting because it's so easy to dismiss if it doesn't come from like the people whose entire like being and history is shaped by colonialism. You know what I mean? Like you can't really like they're the ones that will never like forget about that evil and like kind of walk in. I mean, they accuse themselves of naivete a lot and own that, but like I don't know, it's true, it's you're so right to say, well, like I guess we can draw a distinction between real Creole cultures and like it's like Western capitalist cosmopolitan culture. Like if we can separate those, then I think we're getting somewhere. I mean, like can we or like is that possible? I don't know. But I think like it's politically hopefully a little clarifying. The last thing that I would want to say is like I'm down for pessimism too, but I'm like temperamentally pretty pessimistic, but I think like what they understand also is like there is nothing to go back to. Like it's like the fascistic their critique of rootedness as related to the colony, to this like and Glissant's like worry about stagnation and identity and you know, that's I haven't articulated it well, but like we through and through and through we've read like a lot of warnings against consolidating into a fixed identity or trying to claim something that has a naturalistic or like hereditary kind of legacy or root, you know, like they're very aware of the dangers of that. So I think over something that's a little too sanguine but actively rejects that sort of ethnocentric thinking, I'll take the risks. I don't know. Anyway, is it a good time to say goodbye? If you've made it this far, thanks for tolerating us. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next week.
See you next week.